When are people going to see that nothing ain't never going to change unless somebody finally makes up its mind to stand up and fight? Damn.
Netroots Radio presents Hopping Mad with Will McLeod and Arliss Bunny. Now, here's Will and Arliss.
Welcome to Hopping Mad. I'm Arliss Bunny. Will McLeod is out today with a family emergency. So, a funny thing happened on the way to this show. I thought I had everything all laid out last week. Will and I both kind of knew what we were going to do, and then Will was called away, and then I had a really fabulous interview set up on Puerto Rico, and those had to get rescheduled, so all of a sudden there was magically no show, and in the meantime, I had been doing my prep for this show, and for in particular for the Puerto Rico interviews, and I kept running up against the same thing. And in the process of trying to sort of suss out what's going on with the economy of Puerto Rico, I keep running up against all of these laws that apply to Puerto Rico that are not applicable here in the rest of the country, so we don't notice them. So I started looking into these things, and everything sort of funnels backwards to the very beginning, the very establishment of Puerto Rico as a U.S. entity, and that gets me to something called the insular cases. And let me tell you, trying to figure out the insular cases has taken me 2 days of probably 12 hours of reading on each day. And, you know, people talk about going down the rabbit hole, and let me tell you, going down a rabbit hole, rabbit holes are well-engineered propositions. They have lots of lovely exits and places to nap. This was not that. This was a tangle of confusion and contradiction. And I was trying so very hard to figure it out. I was literally reading the 1901 Supreme Court opinions and trying to wade through all of that. And it just... it was crazy making. And I finally, late last night, I just, in a fit of frustration, I texted to Armando. People who are familiar with the show will recognize that name. Armando is a lawyer who has been on the show several times. And I knew that this is a field that he might actually know something about. So I texted to him and I asked him if he had, by any minuscule chance, had any idea why this Supreme Court justice, a man named Henry Brown, why in 1 year, in back-to-back rulings, which literally came out on the same day, would he decide one way on a particular subject, and then that same day on what appears from the outside to be the same subject, decide the opposite, in the opposite direction. To which Armando, and this is after I have spent hours upon hours upon hours upon hours trying to figure out these insular cases, Armando comes back with this text that says, the insular cases make no sense. It's like, really? Great. This is when you tell me that. So it was that kind of thing. But I did discover, actually, and I think that this is part of why this will make an interesting show. I did discover these really interesting stories along the way about people who were involved in these processes. And in addition to that, I really think that, well, as a physicist, I really am always curious about things at sort of the deepest root level. So that's why I kind of keep going back and going back and going back when I'm looking for answers to things. And I think you probably are somewhat like that too, because Hopping Mad is definitely a deep dive show, and here you are listening to Hopping Mad. So I'm kind of thinking that this matters to you. So What I'm hoping is that by giving you all this background and foundational material today and trying to suss out sort of for you what I have taken out of this process of delving into these laws that undergird everything in Puerto Rico, that you will have a better understanding when we go to these interviews, hopefully in 2 weeks, about Puerto Rico, what's going on with their economy, what's going on in storm recovery, and what's going on with a lot of the law that's swirling around Puerto Rico right now. They have a big case that's going to be going to the Supreme Court that will matter immensely. And so all of those things, I think, will sort of feed in. And I'm hoping that this will help you understand that show a lot better. So also be aware, this show is going to go into Extra Mad. So those of you who are listening on Netroots Radio, go ahead and download Extra Mad, or just actually download the whole show at imhoppingmad.com or on Stitcher or iTunes or Spotify for that matter. The reason is you're only going to basically hear a portion of these stories. And you really, really, really do want to hear me tell you the story of Isabel Gonzalez. I honestly don't know why Isabel Gonzalez is not as common a name and as well known to all of us as Rosa Parks. What this young woman did was as brave and as miraculous and as amazing as what Rosa Parks did, in my view. And I want to tell you her story, or at least a little bit of her story. And in fact, I really now am curious, and I'm going to see if I can't find out a lot more about her and maybe bring someone on who either knows more about her or maybe a member of her family or something to tell us more about her, because she did something... She did something in 1904 I still can't believe a young woman was capable of doing in that period of time. Not capable of, but brave enough to do. This was a big bite, and she took it. And I just was so impressed by what I read about her. So I will get to that story. And if you are listening on Netroots Radio and you haven't yet heard me talk about Isabel Gonzalez, you really, really do want to download the rest of the show so you can hear that. And actually, so you can get updated on the rest of what's going on too, because our show in 2 weeks will make a lot more sense to you. So there are these... Usually Supreme Court cases are basically referred to by individual names and thought of in an individual way. But there's this group of cases that all came to the Supreme Court, or primarily came to the Supreme Court in 1901. And they are collectively known as the Insular cases. They're, from our viewpoint now, they are facially based upon racial supremacy and colonial dominance and, all kinds of things that are really hard to read and hard to swallow now. But at the time, of course, were much more of their time. And I guess one could think more appropriate, though I say that really grudgingly. The Spanish-American War ended in 1898. And it was ended with the Treaty of Paris. As a result of the war, the U.S. acquired these new territories, including Puerto Rico, Guam, the Philippines. And Title IX of the Paris Treaty, which ultimately became something that Congress ratified, called the Foraker Act of 1900. And it dealt with citizenship rights and the lack thereof and all of the things associated with the Treaty of Paris. One of the things it said was that those born in Spain but living in the territories would retain their Spanish citizenship or had the option to become U.S. citizens, parenthesis, because they were white people. Meanwhile, indigenous people... And it actually says, anyway, indigenous peoples became stateless. because they lost their Spanish citizenship. They actually did have Spanish citizenship. They lost their Spanish citizenship, but they were not granted what we would call a path to citizenship now, and for the U.S. And I'm thinking, that just, of course they weren't granted a path to citizenship. We can't even wrap our heads around that now. But, you know, we're so white and so privileged, I guess. Anyway, but a lot of what I'm going to talk to you about when you are hearing these stories back from 1901, 1904, they're going to sound awfully familiar to you. They're going to ring as something you just read in the news yesterday, because these themes continue to run through this country. Under the Foraker Act, the U.S. federal government would appoint a governor for each of the territories, appoint at least a portion of the legislature, and appoint the entire Supreme Court for that territory. So the big questions that weren't resolved in the legislation was, were these people citizens of the United States, and how did U.S. federal law apply in the territories? And you would think, I mean, those are pretty big questions. So those things remained outside of agreement at the time. The 14th Amendment, which passed in 1868 and over which we had by 1900 already fought a pretty devastating war, stated all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. So already you can see that there are, in the case of these territories, there was a discrepancy between what the Constitution said and what the Foraker Act said, and clearly, this was the kind of thing that was going to end up headed for SCOTUS. And what I find interesting is that when the court ultimately considered these questions, and I'll get there in just a minute, but when the court was considering these questions, they were thinking about things like, in a war, if the U.S. wins a territory, for instance, in a war, we took the country of Iraq. So does U.S. citizenship automatically extend to the people who have just been taken into this territory that we have conquered? So the justices, ultimately, they were thinking about things like that because it was a time when there was a much more colonial process going on worldwide, and the overhang, the hangover from a colonial process was still everywhere and rampant. So it wasn't ludicrous for them to be thinking about these things as they thought about places like the Philippines and Puerto Rico. As a side issue, I should just say that the term insular, because I keep talking about the insular cases, is derived from these new territories all falling at that time under the administration of the War Department Bureau of Insular Affairs. Insular is a legal term, and it references, it means basically detached or discrete or removed. And so they were talking about territories which were removed from the mainland of the United States. In 1901, broadly in the insular cases, and I'm going to go from the broad to the specific, SCOTUS held that even if they're U.S. citizens, the full rights of constitutional protection do not extend to the territories ex proprio vigore, which means of its own force. So this means that the Constitution doesn't just automatically extend to places. The rights of U.S. citizenship don't just automatically extend to places that we control, even if we control them wholly and intend to control them permanently. It's interesting. These cases were decided in several cases with a concurrence of opinions, not a majority of opinion. And what that means for those of you who don't you know, hang out on SCOTUS podcasts and blogs, it means that instead of there being five justices or more who decide on one opinion, there can be some combination of five justices who arrive at the same end result. In other words, they agree on the same result, but they get there through a different legal path. Their opinions are different. So that is a concurrence of opinions as opposed to a majority opinion. And clearly, a concurrence of opinion allows for more leeway. It is a less settled matter in terms of the openings for challenge in the future than if something is a majority opinion. So basically, the Insular cases serve to put this thin legal veneer on racism, on bigotry, on colonialism, but they were what they were at the time. And as I go forward and I talk to you a lot about these things, one of the things that was hardest for me as I was going through this process, and that will be, I think, probably hard for most of you, is remembering that 1901 is not 2018 in terms of how people see the world, in terms of perspective. Our viewpoint has changed. And it we do have to, I think, grant a certain amount of leeway for growth, for human growth. That's not to say that we couldn't have done better then. We could have and should have. We just didn't, and we weren't there yet. So the big things that came out of the Insular rulings was this concept of constitutional protections don't extend ex proprio vigore, and the SCOTUS created two categories of territory. They had one group of territories they called incorporated territories, and those were territories they felt were on the path to statehood. So places like Alaska and Hawaii ended up as incorporated territories. Non-incorporated territories, not unincorporated, but what they call non-incorporated territories, those were places that they felt were not on the path to statehood. And into that category is where they put Puerto Rico. I think it's interesting because this was not a division between white and people of color, clearly, when you're talking about these particular places. I think that these places ended up parsed as they did based upon their strategic value to the United States at the time. So Hawaii had, of course, an incredibly critical harbor. Alaska had gold reserves and, you know, you could see Russia from your backyard. Puerto Rico did not have anything really strategic in that way to offer the United States that was dramatic enough at that time. And I think that's why it got put into this non-path to statehood group. What I don't understand is Guam and the Philippines, who were also put in this non-incorporated grouping. And I just wonder if in 1901, because of course the world was seen differently then, if they weren't seen as being quite as strategic then. But I can't imagine that because we had just fought a war about that. So I'm not quite sure, and I could not drill down. I could not find available online, at least, a definition of why Guam, Philippines, and Puerto Rico were separate from the concept of states that were territories that were on the path to statehood. I don't know what the difference was, but clearly there was some difference, and the Supreme Court drew it a pretty hard, dark, wide line when they came down with their Insular case rulings. The problem with the Insular cases is that even though they were written through this lens of 1901, when the world was this very different, very colonial, very racially narrow place, these cases are still the thing that control in Puerto Rico today. They are still in full effect, and the Trump administration has discovered them and is electing to exercise them and their from their most racist perspective to the advantage of Trump. And this, by the way, is how this entire issue came to my attention, or so pricked my attention at this time, was that I read something that Trump had said, and that took me backwards into all of this. So let me get into some specifics about the insular cases. And I'm going to start with Dilema v. Bidwell. And Dilema v. Bidwell was the first insular case argued. It was decided on May 27th of 1901. And it was Dilema Sugar Importing Company, obviously importing sugar, into the Port of New York. And George R. Bidwell, who was the customs inspector for the Port of New York. From our perspective, this case is going to sound a great deal like Downs v. Bidwell, which is the next insular case I'm going to talk to you about. But at the time, as best I can tell, and this is part of the crazy of the insular cases, and I think part of what Armando meant, I think what the court did was that they took both of these extremely, extremely similar cases, Downs and Dilema, and they focused on one set of issues in Downs and another much, much more narrow issue in Dilema. So in Dilema, they focused just on the issue of tariffs. And in the opinion, which I read, the court says they had one question to answer, whether territory acquired by the United States by cession from a foreign power remains a foreign country within the meaning of tariff laws. The Dilema opinion was written by Justice Brown, and I'll tell you more about Justice Brown later because he's an interesting guy. But it acknowledges, he says in the opinion, that he knows that the opinion is going to be used to answer more than just basically questions about tariff and sugar. But they tried very hard in this particular opinion to keep things narrow, to keep it tightly focused on tariffs. And Dilema found that the uniformity clause of the Constitution prevailed in that tariffs imposed on Puerto Rico by Congress in the Foraker Act were unconstitutional because Congress had imposed a 15% tariff on goods coming in from Puerto Rico. They had called that out by name in the Foraker Act. The problem, of course, is the uniformity clause of Article 1 of the Constitution. So what the uniformity clause says is that laws have to be applied evenly across the states and throughout the union. And the question was, to the court was, did that include Puerto Rico? So the problem was that the court had previously established in the previous year that a foreign country was defined to be one exclusively within the sovereignty of a foreign nation and without the sovereignty of the United States. That's how the Supreme Court describes a foreign country. So that doesn't fit Puerto Rico, right? Puerto Rico was not exclusively within the sovereignty of a foreign nation, and they were not without the sovereignty of the United States. So the Supreme Court in Dilema found that the uniformity clause did apply and that Dilema Sugar basically could get their 15% back. Not surprisingly, and you'll learn more about this when I get to my section on Justice Brown, but the opinion also refers to the concerns the justices had around the nationalization of savage tribes. And that's a quote right out of the opinion. So, you know, we can all take a deep breath there and try to move past that for the time being. But they had a great deal of concern. And in the press at the time, and particularly over the next couple of years, there was a lot of discussion about the damage it would do to savage tribes to enforce modern society on them, and the damage that would be done to modern society in having to basically deal with savage tribes. Their lives were so very hard. I mean, the lives of people having to, quote, deal with, you know, having to deal with these other other folks. But I want you to think now about Downs v. Bidwell, because that ruling came out on the very same day. Samuel Downs was importing oranges from Puerto Rico to New York, and George R. Bidwell, this poor guy who ended up at the middle of all of this stuff, was still the customs inspector at Port of New York, and Bidwell levied duties on Downs's oranges. But this case, Downs v. Bidwell, focused on a much bigger issue. And it didn't talk about tariffs for the sake of tariffs, as did De Lima v. Bidwell. It talked about whether the Constitution follows the flag. And that's what I was referring to before when I was talking about whether the Constitution immediately applied in Iraq after we conquered Iraq. So specifically, the justices were not considering whether Puerto Rico was a foreign country. They felt that was settled law at that point in time. What they were considering was whether it was to become an integral part of the United States, and in fact, whether as a result of the Treaty of Paris, it had become what they referred to as an integral part of the United States. So again, through this lens, the Downs argument to the court relied upon the Uniformity Clause, and Bidwell relied upon the Foraker Act, just as had been the case in De Lima v. Bidwell. But in Downs, the court made a distinction between how Puerto Rico is viewed and treated internationally as part of the United States, and how it's treated constitutionally as a non-incorporated territory. They made a distinction between how people see us and how we see us. In the ruling, which is bizarre when you think about it, who the hell cares how you're seen? What matters is how the law functions and how the law speaks. And it's just odd that they specifically talk about how Puerto Rico is viewed as if that had the weight of law. So in Downs, SCOTUS created the previously non-existent distinction between incorporated and unincorporated territories, non-incorporated territories. So don't tell me that judicial activism is this modern phenomenon or strictly the function of liberal courts. Oh, God, no. This is a perfect example of a conservative court creating new law out of whole cloth, because this distinction in territorial types did not exist before. So it's just a bizarre thing that haunts Puerto Rico to this very day. But in Downs, the court turned entirely to the questions around the application of the Constitution to rights, protections, and privileges, specifically in Article 1. Ultimately, the court backed the congressional end run around the Uniformity Clause. And this is what I say when I'm saying that in De Lima, the court ruled one way, and in Downs, they ruled the other way. In De Lima, they ruled that the Uniformity Clause of Article 1 of the Constitution controlled. In Downs, they ruled that the forker controlled in terms of its end run around Article 1, basically what they said, and I did not find this specifically in the opinion, but I believe from what I sussed out was that they were giving deference to the Article 1 authority of Congress to make its own rulings and make its own decisions and make its own legislation. And they do speak to that specifically. They don't speak about it directly in terms of Article 1 authority in the way that we talk about that now, but they kind of moved past the idea of the uniformity clause to the entire concept of congressional authority. And the uniformity clause says that Congress shall levy federal taxes on citizens equally, and the founders' intentions was to, you know, prevent treatment of the wealthy and property owners differently than the rest of us. Yeah, like that worked. Yeah, okay. But the court didn't really apply that in Downs. What they applied was this bigger idea of the power of Congress in Article 1. And of course, the court, even to this day, is very, very careful and very, very, very conscious about when it impinges upon Article 1 or Article 2 powers that relate to the other branches. Perhaps the biggest difference between conservative and liberal justices, both then and now, is that conservative justices view Article 1 and Article 2 authorities from the perspective of Congress and the executive. They try to see them through those lenses, while the liberal justices view those same authorities from the perspective of the people. And, you know, I have a preference in that, but be that as it may. Later, I'm going to talk to you about a modern ruling, and you will see this division and these Article 1 and Article 2 differences when I talk to you about a minority opinion that was a minority dissent that was written by Justice Sotomayor and joined by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, RBG. If you have not, by the way, seen the new documentary on RBG, you must do that. Absolutely fabulous. It's interesting that at the time of the Downs decision, so anyway, I'm sorry, let me go back just one step here. So what I want you kind of to do is to connect the past with the present. And here, when I'm talking about this Sotomayor dissent, I want you to hear this Downs decision and how that touches and doesn't touch how we hear the Franklin decision later on in the show. It's interesting that at the time of the Downs decision, the dissenting opinion was an originalist argument, and indeed, in the opinion, they cite the centrality of Article 1. The dissenting opinion was written by Justice John Marshall Harlan and in part read, "The idea prevails with some. Indeed, it has expression in arguments at the bar that we have in this country substantially, and here we go, two national governments, one to be maintained under the Constitution with all its restrictions, and the other to be maintained by Congress outside and independently of that instrument. By exercising such powers as other nations of the earth are accustomed to, I take leave to say that, if the principles thus announced should ever receive the sanction of a majority of this court, a radical and mischievous change to our system will result. We will, in that event, pass from the era of constitutional liberty, guarded and protected by a written constitution, into an era of legislative absolutism. It will be an evil day for American liberty if the theory of a government outside the supreme law of the land finds lodgment in our constitutional jurisprudence. No higher duty rests upon this court than to exert the full authority to prevent all violation of the principles of the Constitution." Did that sound familiar to you? I read that and I read it again and I thought, okay, so Justice Scalia and Justice Alito, this could have been written by them. This could have come straight out of their mouth. In Downs, the only good thing, or one of the only things, I guess, to flow from Downs that makes sense, and that turned out to be a very, very good thing, was that the court did manage to note that the constitutional guarantees of a citizen's rights of liberty and property were applicable to all. Such guarantees cannot under any circumstances be transcended. But remember that what they're doing with that is making sure that the property rights delineated in the Constitution flowed to property owners in Puerto Rico. So with Downs and Dilema, SCOTUS reserved for Congress, and frankly for itself, the right to pick and choose from the menu of the Constitution what would apply and what would not apply to the territories. Which brings me to Justice Henry B. Brown. Okay, so just real quickly about Justice Brown. He sat on the court for 31 years. He wrote the majority for Downs, but this is a guy who had clear and articulate concerns about the unlikelihood of the ability to civilize savage tribes, about which he writes periodically in his opinions. And he was convinced that indigenous communities were less intelligent, less capable of civil discourse, and therefore unlikely to benefit appropriately from constitutional protections. So that's how he justified himself. He felt that they were unlikely to benefit. But let's put this in a little perspective. This is the guy that authored the majority opinion in Plessy v. Ferguson. So this is the guy that upheld segregation. And because karma's a bitch, Brown built a really beautiful home in Washington, D.C., a mansion, really absolutely gorgeous place. And it had a name. It was very special indeed. He entertained a great deal there. He was very proud of it. It's now the Embassy of the Republic of Congo. That just warms my heart. Anyway, Brown had this bizarre and unique role, and this was part of the story of the insular cases that was so difficult to understand, and which I still don't understand, because the reason that this man operated in this way in the insular cases is not available to me online, and I dug and dug and dug looking for it, and I swear I can't find it. If any of you out there want to, you know, break your backs on the cross of this search, go right ahead. But I really couldn't find it, and I looked pretty hard. The court was actually evenly divided on the status of Puerto Rico as integral to the United States and therefore subject to the Uniformity Clause. It was 4-4. So what made Dilema go one way and Downs go the other way, even though we were talking about cases that had the same basic underlying arguments, was that Brown decided one way in Dilema and the other way in Downs, which is incredibly weird. I mean, that's just weird, right? And these, I mean, again, let me just refresh your memory. These are opinions that came out on the same day, the 27th of May. These were opinions that cross-reference. They refer to each other in the opinions. Brown decided one way in one and the other way in the other. In Downs, he said, patriotic and intelligent men may differ widely as to the desirableness of this or that acquisition, but this is solely a political question. We can only consider this aspect of the case so far as to say that no construction of the Constitution should be adopted which would prevent Congress from considering each case upon its merits unless the language of the instrument imperatively demands it. A false step at this time might be fatal to the development of what Chief Justice Marshall called the American Empire. So clearly, he used Downs to talk about, again, what I was talking about earlier in terms of the Article I protections. Congress needed to be able to consider each case on its merits. That's what he was concerned with in Downs. Why he wasn't concerned with that same thing in Dilema, I have no freaking clue. I really don't. He also then just says, and here we can hear Plessy V. Ferguson come right through this. He says, and if those possessions are inhabited by alien races differing from us in religion, customs, law, methods of taxation, and modes of thought, the administration of government and justice, according to the Anglo-Saxon principles, may for a time be impossible. And the question that at once arises, whether large concessions ought to be made for a time, that ultimately our own theories may be carried out and the blessings of a free government under the Constitution extended to them. Because we are the great white father. I'm sorry, he doesn't say that, but that's what he's saying. We decline to hold that there is anything in the Constitution to forbid such action. So he's saying that he would require the Constitution to forbid this menu picking and choosing for territories in order for him to decide that the Constitution as a whole would immediately apply in a territory where we had conquered, that we had conquered and intended to maintain. Because Brown was not consistent, this one man was not consistent between De Lima and Downs. What that really means is that even in that time, even in 1901, those cases weren't all that firmly decided, and you can see all kinds of battling and returning to the court and that kind of thing that happens as a result of that. But now we treat the insular cases as if they are settled law, and we treat De Lima and Downs as if they are both settled law, even though they are contradictory. So including De Lima and Downs, there were six insular cases decided by, adjudicated by SCOTUS in 1901, and two more were adjudicated by the Puerto Rican Supreme Court. Which, of course, at that point in time was still entirely appointed by Congress. And one of these cases at the time, and okay, I told you earlier that I like to dive into things that I get curious, that I get, you know, caught up about the history of things and what underlies things. So I just read casually as a mention that there's a case called 14 Diamond Rings the United States. So to me, I'm wondering, so instead of Downs, you know, Downs v. Bidwell, why wasn't it Oranges v. Bidwell? But so you got to look that up, right? You got to look up 14 Diamond Rings v. United States, right? Because who can help that? And so what happened in that, and it doesn't involve Puerto Rico, I'm just going to quickly tell you the story. A sailor was assigned to, it was deployed to the Philippines right after the Spanish-American War. And he's there. He's on his base, and he decides to invest in these 14 diamond rings. He's going to bring them back to the States and resell them. Okay, good plan. But between the time that he bought the rings and the time he got back to the States, the Foraker Act passed. So there's this 15% duty that's imposed, this tariff that's imposed. So that case goes to the Supreme Court ultimately, because it just did. It was a complete mess at the time. So instead of having this sailor's name and memorializing that and his clever investment scheme, it memorializes 14 Diamond Rings v. United States. That's how we call the case. It's odd and a little funny. Anyway, so many scholars add one more 1901 case, by the way, Crossman v. United States. So really, when people are talking about the insular cases, they're talking about nine insular cases that involve the three territories. Six of them involve Puerto Rico directly. And as you can see, they often work at cross purposes to one another. So now I'm going to tell you this amazing story about Gonzales v. Williams, which was decided in 1904 and is considered by some modern legal thinkers to be one of the insular cases. Isabel Gonzales And in my notes, it says, Isabel Gonzalez, about whom someone needs to make a movie. And I love this guy, William Williams. The bad guy in this story is a guy named William Williams. He was the commissioner of immigration for the Port of New York, Ellis Island, and a man who came from parental stock, who was perhaps among the least creative people to ever walk the planet. But he was a Wall Street lawyer and got appointed by his friend, the Secretary of the Treasury, to this job, which he really wanted, because he wanted to make a point. This was a man on a mission, and his mission was to make sure that he, like the Department of the Treasury, believed that unmarried women who came to the United States, particularly unmarried pregnant women, and particularly, most especially, unmarried pregnant women of color that came to the United States, were a burden upon the state, regardless of what arrangements their families had made, regardless of, none of that mattered. He felt that they were a burden upon the state, and he wanted to turn them back at Ellis Island. And this, by the way, is at a time when the U.S. is essentially trying to staff up, right? We have thrown open the gates. We're trying to get people here. But Isabel's story actually begins on a boat, right? She's on a boat, and she's traveling from Puerto Rico to New York. She was going there to stay with her aunt and uncle, and she was shortly thereafter going to be married to her fiancé, who had also moved to New York to work, to get a job, to get a good job. Her uncle had a great job, and he was able to secure a job for Isabel's fiancé. So fiancé, right, gets on boat, goes to New York to live in, you know, very close there to Isabel's aunt and uncle in Linoleumville, Staten Island. Okay, I didn't have time to get into this last night, but I'm just going to take a wild guess that I suddenly know where linoleum comes from. Anyway, while Isabel was, and I should say, Isabel was a widow. She already had a young child, and she was pregnant. So while Isabel was en route to New York from Puerto Rico, the Department of Treasury changed the immigration rules. This is like when Trump put the Muslim ban in place and people were trapped in airports. So they've changed the immigration rules. So instead of just being able to, you know, arrive at the Port of New York, she gets rerouted to Ellis Island. And there's this whole new process. And Williams rejected her entry because she was an unmarried woman of color. Now, one of the things that he required was that the immigrant had to have $10, which at that time was quite a lot of money. Isabel had $11. And they had to have family basically waiting there to pick them up. And Isabel did indeed have family there waiting to pick her up. But William Williams was not impressed because her fiancé was not there. Well, her fiancé had a new job. He couldn't get the time off work. And William Williams was only there during work hours on work days. So the fiancé could not be there. So Isabel was not allowed entree to the United States, and she was therefore housed on Ellis Island. And William Williams was, of course, making his unmarried pregnant brown women point. And Isabel was screwed. She was so screwed, right? She's pregnant. She's got a small child. She's stuck there. Meanwhile, of course, in New York City, you know, it's West Side Story for real. And Puerto Ricans were facing this incredibly energetic, widely, wildly promulgated racism. But at the same time, because of the insular cases in 1901, there is a group of lawyers, including one of the lawyers who represented Downs in 1901, and they are looking for a test case for Puerto Rico and citizenship, to test the question of citizenship for Puerto Ricans. And somehow through, you know, a family, through, you know, Isabel's aunt and uncle, through friends, through, you know, there's a sort of long circuitous path These guys find Isabel. They stumble across her case because she's met all the criteria, right? She should be in, but she's not. And Isabel is continuing to pursue her case from that perspective. Her family comes, this thing goes to court, and the judge rules against her because while her family is there and she has the money and she has all the other things in place, her fiance still isn't there because the man is working. So the judge doesn't take her, but she does get released on bond. And just as an aside, and it doesn't really play into the story, but she did quietly marry her fiance during that period of time while she was out on bond. And she could have stopped pursuing her case at that time, but she didn't, because she could have stopped pursuing her case because now she's married to an American citizen. So that conferred citizenship upon her at the time, but she didn't. What had happened was that these lawyers had found her. They convinced her to change her tactic from appealing about the specifics of her entry under immigration law as an alien immigrant to challenging the fact that she was being considered an alien at all. So they changed from what would have been this normal, small, tiny, you know, Isabel could have just said, this pregnant, young, you know, woman in her early 20s could have just said, sure, but, you know, you guys are nice and all, but I'm married now, and I have a child to raise, and, you know, a husband to care for, and a house, you know, a home to build, and I just, you know, enough is enough. But she didn't, because Isabel was tough, and Isabel was a fighter. So what she did instead was that she said yes to these guys. So this case ended up, Isabel's case, ended up going to the Supreme Court. It worked its way up through the federal system and ends up going to the Supreme Court. And it is the beginning of the process. She didn't obtain citizenship for Puerto Ricans, but it was the beginning of the process. It was definitely after that point in time, the dominoes started to fall. The backdrop of this, again, is that there's an enormous discussion in the press and the public about immigration in general, particularly about the treatment of women and children of color. It's all over the New York Times, these articles about immigration and the terrible treatment of women and children, and particularly people of color. And I'm thinking, wait, that's 1904? That sounds like 2018. You know, there's this through thread from Isabel Gonzalez's life straight to us right now. And it's really, really fascinating. In the case, the question Isabel's case revolved around a phrase in the Treaty of Paris, Spain cedes to the United States the island of Puerto Rico. And the court determined that with the treaty, the nationality of the residents of Puerto Rico changed from Spanish to that of the United States. So they became U.S. nationals. And they determined that Puerto Ricans were, and I love this phrase, non-citizen nationals, whatever the hell that means. So they went from being aliens to being non-citizen nationals at that moment because of Isabel Gonzalez. But Isabel wasn't done yet. She began a letter-writing campaign to the New York Times, and a number of those got published, and it was the beginning of sort of the shaming of America at a time when apparently we could actually still be shamed, and it raised visibility. Isabel and her legal friends raised the visibility of the concept of Puerto Rican citizenship. And so what then happened was that other much more powerful, much more wealthy, U.S.-based Puerto Ricans took up the cause. But Isabel gave it a human face. And by 1917, Congress passed the Jones-Shoffrith Act, which granted citizenship to all Puerto Ricans and provided those who were eligible to be drafted into the military service just in time for World War I, which was in no doubt baked into the math of legislators. So just when you think it's a victory, they pull the rug out from under you. But Isabel's story is nevertheless an incredible one, and I'm happy to tell it here on Hopping Mad. I'll be back in Extra Mad with a lot more that gets us into the modern time and the modern cases, because I pretty well run through the insular cases at this point in time. So I'll be back on Extra Mad in just a moment. Bunny. I'm back with Extra Mad from Hopping Mad. And I've been talking about Puerto Rico. I'm going to continue talking about Puerto Rico. That's the theme of the day. But I want to come to modern, basically modern history now. And in order to get there, on January 15th, 1899, right after the signing of the Treaty of Paris, the military government in Puerto Rico, the U.S. military government, changed the name of Puerto Rico to Puerto Rico. So on May 17th, 1932, U.S. Congress changed the name back. But on January 15th, 1899, again, right after signing of Treaty of Paris, the island's currency was changed from the Puerto Rican peso to the American dollar. So they had a dollar union with us right there from the outset. And the U.S. exerted its control over the economy of the island by prohibiting, and this is something that I have talked about on shows before, this is where it comes from, the U.S. has prohibited the island from negotiating commercial treaties with other nations, which of course would be true with any state, and from determining tariffs, which of course is a federal responsibility. But here's the kicker, and this is the one I've talked about, from shipping goods to the mainland on other than U.S. carriers. This has been problematic for Puerto Rico in many times and in many ways, in that their port is very much limited to U.S. vessels. And even in an emergency, even in something like Hurricane Maria, that is, it's an enormous problem because every country in the world can't just send aid by sending a flag, you know, a ship bearing its own flag there. Because in 1899, these guys, somebody had the corner on U.S. shipping in that territory, no doubt. In 1950, the U.S. Congress gave Puerto Rico the right to local control. They could decide on local control. And so Public Law 600 was passed in 1952, and the people of Puerto Rico adopted their own constitution. They took over local control, so they had a measure of autonomy. So they were similar to other states at that point in time. Kind of. Not entirely, but kind of. The U.S. federal government still absolutely had their thumb on the scale. So that brings us to, there were other cases in between, of course, a number of them. But what I want to talk about today is Puerto Rico v. Franklin, California Tax-Free Trust. It's a mouthful. So it's the Franklin California Tax-Free Trust. That was the lead bondholder, the lead on that side of the case. So I'll call them Franklin. So it's Puerto Rico v. Franklin. Here's background on the problem. Puerto Rico, as I have talked about on the show in the past, has been in deep recession since 2006. They have this enormous public debt of $123 billion between debt and pension obligations. And absolutely out of control spending on public utilities. The energy, water, roads, and transportation are all just, it's a nightmare there. It's an absolute nightmare. And of course, absolutely made infinitely worse by Hurricane Maria. So of course, in order to try to fix these problems, and because, you know, in order to have graft, you have to have money coming in, Puerto Rico offered bonds to meet its financial needs. And because there's no form of risk too great for U.S. investment banks, those bonds were snapped up. And now those investors are sniveling, and it is incredibly frustrating to me. The point of the stock market is that it's a risk. The point of something like bonds are that they are a risk. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Somebody buying bonds on an economy they know is deeply constrained and has incredible structural limitations and problems, what kind of idiot buys that bond in the first place? I mean, it's nice to help the people of Puerto Rico and all, but this was crazy making. Nobody in their right mind. I wouldn't spend my hard-earned money on it. I hope you wouldn't, but investment banks, man, they couldn't get it fast enough. There is, Puerto Rico does, as does, in fact, the state of Illinois, have an incredible problem with corruption. And PREPA, who is their Puerto Rican electric power utility, this is just an example. They want billions to move the island from 100% oil to 60% natural gas, 40% solar. This is before Maria. All of the money in that proposal is in natural gas. They want to convert two existing plants that run on oil to run on natural gas. And they want to build two new natural gas plants. And they want an extremely expensive, and here's the one you should pay attention to, an extremely expensive offshore gas port facility. Meanwhile, they're not dropping any of the contracts they hold on their oil plants. They're still planning to run those, and it's still in their long-term planning. So they're speaking out of two sides of their mouth. In a place with, I mean, I don't understand. Well, it's corruption. This drive for fossil fuels in Puerto Rico. This is a place with nearly constant sun and wind, and they want to import natural gas. It's ridiculous. It's beyond ridiculous. If you've ever seen the movie Spaceballs, it's what in that movie would be plaid. Not to mention that energy requirements in Puerto Rico are falling. First of all, because people are moving to renewables. Companies, that corporations that are there, that kind of thing. People are moving to renewables because it makes sense. To solar, because it makes sense. And the population is shrinking to some degree, and people are just more efficient about how they use energy. So the Oversight Management Board of Puerto Rico has estimated that their energy projections for 2023 are down by 24%. PREPA's concept of building all this stuff is crazy. Just converting the existing plants would solve the problem. If you still wanted to run on fossil fuels, if you were determined and dedicated to running 60% of the energy needs for a country that has more solar than it knows what to do with off of fossil fuels, you can do that by converting the two plants. You don't need to build anything new. Because there are debt reduction requirements all across Puerto Rico at all levels of government, the only way for PREPA to meet the requirements set for them by the Oversight Board is to reduce their annual fuel spending by $400 to $500 million. And the only way to get there is to go heavily after solar. So of course they're going heavily after natural gas. But they're crazy as a fox about that, because natural gas producers up here on the mainland in the States are strongly pushing for the development of the gas port, because their intention is to have that gas port built there so that they can then export to natural gas to the rest of the Caribbean that doesn't need it either, because they have the same solar advantages that Puerto Rico has. Anyway, but it's worse, because all of this gas port, these conversions, these new plants, all of this is heavily supported by Rob Bishop, the Utah representative and House Natural Resources Committee chair, who, of course, is sitting in what natural gas country? And it's also weirdly supported by Jennifer Gonzalez Colon, Puerto Rico's non-voting rep in Congress. And I don't know what her deal is, but I would imagine it has to do with money. There is a promise, by the way, to PREPA that they're going to reduce to 16 cents a kilowatt hour the cost of energy, but there's never been any documentation as to how this number was derived, and it doesn't include any debt service cost, and the debt service cost for PREPA is substantial. So there's no possible way that this energy reduction cost is going to happen unless they go to solar. So corruption is just baked into this whole thing in Puerto Rico, but it isn't, you know, it is across this country too. So it's not like I'm shocked and amazed. That Puerto Rico is not unusual in that regard. So let me get back to the Franklin CA argument and what's going on at the Supreme Court. Puerto Rico's bondholders, led by Franklin CA, argued that under the takings clause of the Constitution, assets cannot be taken by the state without, quote, just compensation. And just compensation is a term of art there, a legal term of art. They also argue that the 1984 amendment to the bankruptcy law, which bars Puerto Rico and D.C. from having access to U.S. bankruptcy, controls. The governor of Puerto Rico argued that the 1984 law left the territory with no functional recourse, since particularly at this time, Congress is also running away as fast as possible from taking responsibility. And of course, they're doing that because if they vote for debt relief for Puerto Rico, the Republicans will melt down And if they vote not to relieve Puerto Rico's debt, if they actually hold a vote on that, then they're voting to basically sink Puerto Rico. And they've already been through that once and they took a hit for it in the polls. They don't want to do that again, particularly not this close to an election. So there's that. So there was a ruling in, there's a Supreme Court ruling in Puerto Rico v. Franklin, and it's a 5-2 decision in favor of Franklin. Thomas wrote for the majority, always a good sign, right? Roberts, Kennedy, Breyer, and Kagan agreed with him. Alito was recused from this, by the way, because he holds Puerto Rican bonds. And let's go back to what I was saying about that earlier. But Thomas said, our constitutional structure does not permit the court to rewrite the statute that Congress has enacted. And in that regard, he's talking about the Foraker Act that I talked about earlier and about the 1984 amendment. And then, remember earlier, I was talking about Sonia Sotomayor and the minority opinion that she wrote with RBG. And she agreed with the argument of the Puerto Rican government, but added that there's a clear and present real-world humanitarian crisis for which resolution should not be impeded by congressional infighting. In other words, different than what Justice Brown said in 1901, she's saying that we have to live in the real world as well. We can't just live in the law. We have to live in the real world as well. And in the real world, this is a significant humanitarian crisis. And this was before Hurricane Maria. So take all of this and amplify it by a million, basically. She said, Congress should step in to resolve Puerto Rico's crisis, but in the interim, the government and the people of Puerto Rico should not have to wait for possible congressional action to avert the consequences of unreliable electricity, transportation, and safe water, consequences that members of the executive and legislature have described as a looming humanitarian crisis. She wrote this under the Obama administration, and it only gets worse from there. They ruled that federal law preempts Puerto Rico from enacting its own bankruptcy laws, and they forced Puerto Rico to be entirely reliant upon the U.S. Congress, in which it has no voting voice, and to rely upon Congress to determine its path forward. They continued to restrain Puerto Rico under basically under a colonial yoke without the virtues of the accompanying support and assistance beyond what is absolutely the bare minimum. Meanwhile, at the same time, this was going on. So this is going on in the judicial branch. In the legislative branch, at the same time, and in fact, on the day this opinion was released, the House passed its version of PROMESA out of Congress. And PROMESA is the Puerto Rico Oversight and Management Economic Stabilization Act. And I talked about this at the time it was passed on the show, so it will be familiar to those of you who have been following us for a long time. It was passed by Congress entirely and signed by Obama in July of 2016. PROMESA looks from the outside like it was intended to serve the interests of Puerto Rico, but really, I want to be very clear about this. It is strongly tilted to protect the economic interests of the United States. It's not about them. It's about us. Just to be, you know, clear on that. Obviously, the GOP opposed debt relief. They went on the air and said things like this at the time. They intended to teach Puerto Rico to be responsible. They wanted Puerto Rico to explain what it did with the money before it gets any more help. It's still that great white father thing. It's still what Justice Brown wrote in 1901. It's still with us. And PROMESA is a perfect encapsulation to express that. PROMESA had a form of bankruptcy written into it because, of course, as I said earlier, Puerto Rico was prevented from accessing bankruptcy. But PROMESA had a form of bankruptcy written into it called Title III, kind of similar to Chapter 9 in Bankruptcy Code. So in accordance with PROMESA, SCOTUS, specifically Justice Roberts, appointed a federal district judge to oversee Title III matters. And that's a woman named Judge Laura Taylor Swain. And Judge Swain, I'll talk a little bit more about her today, but you will also see her name in the news. If you follow Puerto Rico, this is a name you will see. You'll also see Judge Judith Dean, or Dine, and she's dealing with specific federal matters outside of bankruptcy law. PROMESA also created the Fiscal Agency and Financial Advisory Authority, FAFA, and people refer to this as the Oversight Board or the Fiscal Authority Board or a bunch of different names, but it manages the operational function. So PROMESA is the law and the Oversight Board is the actual operation, the functional arm of the law. And it's striving to meet the debt obligations by drastically cutting essential services, including utilities and cleverly disaster preparedness. It's closing; they're closing over 100 schools. They're slashing Medicare. And if you follow the Daily Kos, you will have seen coverage on the front page of Daily Kos about that. They're cutting current pension payments by 10%. And they're people who are currently government workers, government employees, are being moved from a pension to essentially 401k plans. The problem with PROMESA is that there is no existing body of precedent to use as guidance, as you know, legal precedent. So there are more than 75 suits pending against PROMESA and or the Oversight Board trying to hash all that out, trying to work through that. But 75 suits takes time. And bankruptcy is supposed to be expeditious and pragmatic and quickly addressed. And there are 75 lawsuits. So it's not happening. So they've created this bog, basically. The other problem with PROMESA is that in the formation of PROMESA, the federal government, Congress, treated Puerto Rico in some sections as a territory and in other sections as a sovereign, which, again, and this goes back to the insular laws and the division between the uniformity clause and the application of the uniformity clause in Downs and DeLima, that same thread brings us right to here, where in some things the uniformity clause applies and Puerto Rico is treated as a territory, and in other places it doesn't, and Puerto Rico is treated by us as a sovereign. But in all cases, the consistent thing, because there is something that's consistent about this, in all cases, you can answer the question, what best benefits the United States and the economy of the United States? And that will be the way it comes out in PROMESA. That will be how it's written to lean in the PROMESA code. So under Title III of PROMESA, there are organizations and groups that have essentially filed bankruptcy, including the government of Puerto Rico itself, PREPA, which is the Puerto Rican Electric Power Utility I mentioned earlier, incredibly corrupt, COFINA, which is the Sales Tax Financing Corporation, the Highway and Transportation Authority, and ERS, which is the Government Employee Pensions. COFINA, this last week, on August 8th, reached a deal with bondholders. They'll save $17.5 billion on debt service cost. The top-level bondholders will take a small, what's called a haircut. They'll take a reduced return. And the subsidiary bondholders will be cut by 42% in terms of return. So the bondholders are having to take it in the teeth to some minor degree in some cases, but the COFINA was able to reach an agreement, which is good, I guess. So you have the Franklin case, which was decided in July of 2016, and then at that same time, Congress passed PROMESA, July 2016. Now let's go to the U.S. Court of Claims in July of 2017, so last year. So we go 1 year and you get to the U.S. Court of Claims. The Puerto Rico bondholders sued the U.S. government. Bondholders claim that the Puerto Rico government sale of pension assets constitutes a taking under Article 5 of the takings clause, and requires just compensation under the U.S. Constitution. Under the U.S. Constitution. So they want this to be considered in light of constitutional law. This is important because it's arguing that PROMESA operates with territorial jurisdiction and authority, but that PROMESA itself falls under the U.S. Constitution because it was created by U.S. law, and therefore constitutional law controls. So PROMESA and FAFSA are federal entities. That's what the PR bondholders are arguing. The U.S. government is countering that PROMESA law clearly establishes. In the law, it says that it's establishing a board as an entity within the territorial government of Puerto Rico, and it will not be considered part of the U.S. government. It says that in the law. But just last month, so a year again, so we've had a two-year, we've gone through the establishing of PROMESA in July of 2016. This case was filed in July of 2017. Now in July of 2018, the U.S. Court of Federal Claims ruled in favor of the bondholders. This is Judge Susan Braden. And they affirm PROMESA as being constitutional in its authority. She said that it's a federal institution because PROMESA was created by Congress in 2016 and the board members are appointed at a federal level. She also noted that Congress, and this was argued by the bondholders, Congress has directed the CBO to treat PROMESA as federal. And in creating PROMESA, Congress did not repeal something called the Tucker Act, which waives U.S. sovereign immunity in particular cases. So the case is rightfully under the U.S. Court of Claims, and therefore the takings clause of the Fifth Amendment applies. So she's saying that Puerto Rico falls under constitutional law. Now let's go back to what I said earlier in the show in the insular cases about the Constitution following the flag. And under Downs, what the Supreme Court said at the time was that the Constitution does not follow the flag. So if the flag takes a territory, the Constitution doesn't necessarily flow there. What Judge Braden is saying is that because of the way PROMESA is structured, that the Constitution has flowed into a greater portion of Puerto Rico as if it's filling up a glass. And it's now filled this section called PROMESA. Meanwhile, also on the same day, this last month, July 14th, the U.S. District Court, and this is Judge Laura Taylor Swain, who, as I said, was overseeing the bankruptcy. She was appointed by Justice Roberts, and she's overseeing the Title III bankruptcy under PROMESA. She's hearing a similar case to the one being heard by Judge Braden in the Federal Court of Claims. She's in the bankruptcy process in bankruptcy court, and her ruling went the other way. And she says that the board is, PROMESA is territorial because it was created by Congress by virtue of the territorial clause, aka the property clause, of Article 4 of the Constitution. So Braden has stayed her case. She waited for Swain's ruling, and now all of it, everything's on hold because obviously this is headed to the Supreme Court. So we're all going to hear more about this in the not too hideously distant future. The point of saying all of this is that when you look at what's going on in the economy of Puerto Rico, you cannot separate the inability of Puerto Rico to recover from Hurricane Maria and the inability of the Puerto Rican economy to function smoothly. You cannot separate that from the insular cases as they flow down to modern law and the application of modern law in Puerto Rico. It is all of a piece, and it is different than what we deal with here in what I deal with and what the government here in the state of Indiana deals with, what the very bankrupt government in the state of Illinois is dealing with. What Puerto Rico is facing is a whole different level of impediment. And it was imposed originally because of this very racist colonial perspective from 1901. And that is what we have to cut loose. Puerto Rico will, at some point in time, have to decide for itself whether it becomes a state or whether it becomes sovereign. And we should give them the right to do that. We really, really, really need to give them the right to make up their own mind. But in between now and then, we need to cut away this level of impedimenta that is holding them back. because they cannot recover, they cannot heal, they cannot grow, they cannot move forward in their economy until we fix this crap. It's just that simple. Well, it's not simple. It's in fact, incredibly, incredibly complicated. But this is something that people have got to find a way through to fix. And here's why. You know, there's a starting point for all searches. And I told you earlier that it was because I had heard President Trump talking about Puerto Rico in this extremely racist way. And that pricked at me. And then I read this on Daily Coast, and I'm just going to read it to you straight out. It's short, but it is by Rebecca Pilar Buckwalter Poza. We have invited her to be on the show, so I'm hoping to have her in 2 weeks, fingers crossed. This article is called, or this blog post is called, Trump's Using Racist Supreme Court Precedent to Justify Neglecting Puerto Rico. She wrote this on June 11th of this year. Pretty much all of the most racist Supreme Court precedent I'm familiar with, that's still law, key modifier being still, concerns Puerto Rico. There's the turn of the century set, the insular cases, which gave Congress carte blanche to keep Puerto Rico as an unincorporated territory indefinitely. Granted, it's debatable whether the justices intended that outcome or Congress just took advantage of the court's failure to insert a sunset provision, which would have specified when the arrangement had to end in either statehood or independence. Then there's the 1978-1980 duo of California v. Torres and Harris v. Rosario. And just so you all know, I did actually look those up and read those as well. And again, they really, really take us back directly to those insular cases. By then, the justices had recognized that overt racism may not be their best look. So the court issued per curiam opinions from the court rather than individuals. And basically the court tries to clean up the language and shove the racism under the carpet, under the rug, but it's still there. Trust me when I say it's still very much there. So you've never heard of them? These two cases address challenges to the federal policy of shortchanging Puerto Rico residents with respect to aid to families with dependent children and supplemental security income. The Supreme Court decided once, then again, that Congress only had to have a rational basis for doing so. In this legal context, the rational basis, of course, is any reasoning that the court can imagine a legislature rationally thinks to hold up. It's a very, very, very low standard. In other words, if Congress can come up with any plausible reason, any rational basis for denying or drastically cutting or massively minimizing aid to families with dependent children and the supplemental security income, they were welcome to do so by the Supreme Court. In 1978, the rational basis arguments for discriminating against Puerto Rico were that its residents didn't contribute enough to the Treasury, that it was too expensive to include Puerto Rico in federal programs, that inclusion, and she hit this sentence in the same way that I did, that inclusion might seriously disrupt the Puerto Rican economy. So keeping people from starving might seriously disrupt the Puerto Rican economy. Good to know. What she says is, reread that last sentence. Then consider the 1980 clarification, quote, greater benefits could disrupt the Puerto Rican economy. Again, they're saying the same thing over again. Keeping people from starving could disrupt the Puerto Rican economy. Back to Rebecca's article. The Supreme Court of the United States accepted a racist generalization about the propensity of Puerto Ricans to work and to provide for their families as a rational basis for denying them the same federal benefits as stateside Americans. And here's where we go out of the rabbit hole and into the fire. The Trump administration, specifically Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, is now attempting to use that same reasoning to defend against a new version of challenge to the status quo that never should have been established. Filed April 13th, the complaint brought by Sixta Gleas Pena Martinez challenges Puerto Rico's exclusion from SSI and SNAP benefits, as well as Medicare Part D low-income subsidies under the Equal Protection Clause. So basically, the Trump administration is saying that none of these programs should apply to Puerto Rico. Martinez is saying that there is an equal protection clause and therefore these programs should be applied equally. The Justice Department is moving to dismiss on July 25th, and they lean explicitly and heavily on explicitly racist precedents set by the court 40 years ago. And again, go back to these insular cases. That's why they're so important. That's why I spent so much time on them today. They are not as explicit in adopting racist reasoning and words, I might add, but they've incorporated it by citing their case and quoting the portions that specifically uphold that rationale for discrimination against Puerto Rico. Under Trump, the federal government's not just still saying that it's too expensive to uphold the Constitution when it comes to Puerto Rico. That's not a real legal defense with respect to states, by the way. The Trump administration is actively repeating rhetoric that suggests racism is a rational basis for denying Puerto Rico critical federal benefits in a situation of dire need. Yes, that is your government in action. So, elections have consequences. This is just another example. Things were bad in Puerto Rico before. They're very, very much worse now. A journalist had to sue to find out how many people actually died in Puerto Rico in Hurricane Maria. Puerto Rico is having to sue to try to maintain Medicare benefits. It is every little tiny step of the way. The federal government, you'll be glad to know. We are out of the recovery stage for Hurricane Maria, and according to the federal government, and now we can be looking really more at long-term projects there. They're pulling out food, and they're pulling out generators, and they're pulling out water purification resources. All of those kinds of things are going away because the recovery stage is over for Hurricane Maria. You know, make a note. Anyway, we will be back to Puerto Rico again in 2 weeks with a really, really strong show, I think, at the time. I hope that all of this long, long show talking about this in such great depth will help you understand what we're talking about when we get to that point in time. I just always think it helps to have a foundation. And we've got that now, so we'll go from there here on Hopping Mad. Will and I send out our thanks to Netroots Radio, and in particular to Justice Putnam. Justice introduced Will and I, and without him, there really, truly would be no Hopping Mad. Our show's editor, Michelle Ashore, has made it possible for us to stick with it due to her diligent efforts on our behalf. The broadcast version of Hopping Mad airs on Netroots Radio at 8 a.m. on Mondays. The full podcast version of our show is on Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, Radio Public, and Spotify. Our website is imhoppingmad.com, and you can listen to, download, or comment on the show there. We do love to hear from you, but we also have pretty consuming day jobs, so please understand that if we can, we'll get back to you right away, but if we can't, please just have a little patience. We'll get back to you as soon as we can. For fast, if short comment, you can also find us on Twitter at I'm Hopping Mad. Will is on Twitter at WillMcLeod99, and I'm there as, obviously, Arliss Bunny. Hopping Mad is the place on Progressive Radio for deep dive down the rabbit hole coverage of politics, economics, and, of course, carrots. Until next week, cheers.